You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Is the force still with Jack Dorsey? When investors came for Twitter's co-founder, last of the superhero tech CEOs, luck, mojo, and the coronavirus gave him a last-minute reprieve. But Can It Last? By Nick Bilton. With opening photo of Jack Dorsey by Michelle Grosskopf. For the past 4.5 years, Jack Dorsey has been living his best life. While the 43-year-old multi-billionaire is one of the only CEOs on the S&P 500 who oversees two public companies, Twitter and Square, with more than 8,000 employees, and as an angel investor or advisor to startups, he might be one of the least stressed out people in America. As he talked about last year when he went on a podcasting spree, each day Dorsey wakes up in his multi-million dollar glass mansion with postcard views of the Golden Gate Bridge, checks to see what the sleep tracking ring on his finger says, then lowers himself into an ice bath before meditating in a warm tent sauna. This is followed by a 7-minute workout and then drinking his breakfast, which he calls salt juice, a concoction of water, salt, and lemon, which is the only thing he will eat until the evening when he enjoys his single real meal of the day. His day wraps up in a slightly more extreme version of the way it began, with a ritual of 15 minutes in his barrel sauna, followed by 3 minutes in his ice bath, which he does back and forth 3 times for an hour. He then meditates again. People close to Dorsey caution, though, that his health routine changes frequently, so what he's doing now likely doesn't align with what he talked about months ago. Dorsey, who is around 6 feet tall, has a long, scraggly beard that some liken to one of the lead singers from ZZ Top, and the build of a man who only eats once a day. He enjoys working from home at least 2 days a week, often in his kitchen, or at his desk under the glow of a near-infrared light. When he does go into the office, he always walks the 5 miles there. Dorsey also spends a large amount of time on the road, but not in a way that most CEOs of public companies do. He goes on 10-day silent retreats to places like Myanmar, and last year went on a round-the-world trip over several months to visit satellite offices of Twitter, where he was treated like an A-list celebrity and posed for selfies with low-level employees, which he then shared on Twitter. Again, a man living his best life. Dorsey is treated like a celebrity, partially because the media has spent the past decade comparing him to the second coming of Steve Jobs, and as such, the greatest founder of a generation. He spends a large amount of time in Los Angeles, hanging out with celebrities like Kanye West and Kim Kardashian. Basking in Rick Rubin's hot tub in Malibu, or attending dinner parties with Brian Grazer. West recently said in an interview that Dorsey is his favorite founder and a visionary. Dorsey has been the last person standing in the era of the tech CEO as holy man, a near deity. But eras sometimes come to an end. This became apparent in late February when Elliott Management, a hedge fund known for activist investing that controls almost $40 billion in assets, reached out to Twitter to say that after purchasing $1 billion of Twitter stock, it was going to demand changes at the social network. Dorsey and his board of directors shrugged off the threat as nothing more than a little flexing by some private equity bankers trying to make a buck off of Dorsey's notoriety. Dorsey and many around him believe that, much like Jobs in the 1980s, without Dorsey there to oversee both Twitter and Square, they will inevitably fail. To some, that's an old-fashioned view, a Silicon Valley superstition. In the eyes of Elliot, Twitter is failing precisely because Dorsey is there. Leading the charge to expel him was Jesse Cohn, who heads U.S. equity activism at Elliot, and who was recently described by William D. Cohen in a profile as a millennial version of Gordon Gekko. Cohn has a reputation in situations like this. He oversaw the ousting of the CEOs of both Athena Health and eBay, among countless other companies, and has made a blood sport of sniffing out weak CEOs at undervalued companies, forcing himself onto their boards and jostling for change until he gets his way. With his firm making hundreds of millions of dollars in the process. One longtime observer of Cohn described him as an effing killer who will do whatever it takes. In the past, during previous similar coups, Elliot has employed extreme tactics to do so, including hiring private investigators to find dirt on board members. Elliot management declined to comment for this article. Twitter also declined to comment. Among Elliot's requests, or demands, depending on which side of the table you're on, were three board seats. Elliot was nominating four new directors, one clearly as an insurance policy, subsequent changes to Twitter's upper management, and most important, Dorsey's ouster as CEO, or that he step down from running Square and focus solely on Twitter. And while Elliot may no longer employ private investigators, the fear that Cohn can elicit once he gets into the henhouse of a company is still very real. The Cohn observer said that he makes even the most resilient and ruthless CEOs sweat and always, always throws them off their game. Upon hearing the news, Dorsey and his board were all pretty unruffled. One of Dorsey's executives laughed the threats off to me as a pie-in-the-sky dream to oust the famous founder. And while few people on Earth want Dorsey to be running two companies, other than Dorsey himself, he had no intention of ever stepping down from either, at least of his own accord. Twitter employees have told me in the past that it's difficult to get Dorsey's attention while he's focused on Square. And Square employees have told me they have long been frustrated by Dorsey's lack of focus on their company and his obsession with Twitter. As one person from Square put it to me last year, we're like the uglier but more successful stepchild. Still, when an investor owns a large amount of your company, you have no choice but to engage with them. So a few weeks after the initial calls between Elliot and Twitter, according to three people familiar with the discussions, Cohn and one of his partners flew to the Bay Area to meet with Omid Kordestani, executive chairman at Twitter, another Twitter executive, and a third-party banker from Goldman Sachs. The meeting was rushed and took place in a neutral location, not Twitter, and while Dorsey did not attend, he was welcome to join, as most CEOs often do during these salvos. The bland conference room where the bankers and Twitter executives all met was bare. There were no refreshments. At first, according to the three sources, both sides of the table joked around, made some small talk, and then the Twitter folks ask what Elliot really wanted, as if the initial conversation was the first chip in a negotiation. Cohn, according to the sources, reiterated his list of intentions, that he was nominating four new directors to Twitter's board to fill three seats, that the company was drastically undervalued for the space, and, most important, that he was seeking to make Dorsey Twitter's full-time CEO, if not oust him, given that the business has essentially floundered under his tutelage. When Cordestani and his compatriots returned to Twitter, they looked worried, according to two people familiar. It was clear that Elliott management smelled blood, and they were getting ready to attack. In Silicon Valley, tech founders embody all of the industry's highest values, much like Greek gods. Someone like Dorsey, who goes on silent meditation retreats, dresses in couture costumes, runs two companies at the same time, and dates supermodels, is the epitome of making it. For a long time, Wall Street really couldn't argue with the cult of the founder philosophy, as it's called, as tech companies grew exponentially, reaching valuations of more than $1 trillion, and making everyone holding on to those rocket ships insanely rich. Even when tech entered its backlash phase a few years ago and page views or new user signups started to fall, tech CEOs simply changed the metrics investors were told to follow based on whichever number was rising that quarter, so market caps continued to grow and the street continued to make money. People like Dorsey, Elizabeth Holmes, Travis Kalanick, and Adam Neumann were likened to sagacious geniuses with a few peculiarities. Their eccentricities were simply brushed aside as investors counted their billions. Yet, in recent years, as one startup after another has fallen under the weight of its own bullshit, the cult of the founder has given way to a much more realistic reality. Holmes of Theranos touted herself as a green juice-drinking Dalai Lama-like leader who was inspired to start one of her blood-testing technologies after her uncle died of cancer too soon. Yet in reality, she wasn't that close with her uncle. He passed away years after she launched the blood-testing company, and she was about as compassionate a leader as the head of the Geheimstaatspolizei. It turned out the entire technology behind Theranos' famed Edison machine was digital snake oil, leading the company's value, once more than $9 billion, to fall to less than zero. Neumann, the abnormal founder of WeWork, walked around the office barefoot like a sage from Nepal, drank shots of caviar in the morning to revitalize himself, and slapped himself in the face in high-level meetings in lieu of coffee after a rollicking evening of partying, according to an executive who witnessed this. Neumann also told people he would live forever and become the world's first trillionaire. Yet, mere months after he proclaimed that WeWork was worth $47 billion, it turned out that almost every metric imaginable was exaggerated, and that the real value of WeWork was 80% lower, around $8 billion. Kalanick, the agro co-founder of Uber, was seen as the next Jeff Bezos in business until the dam cracked and revealed that Kalanick was allowing managers to harass employees without consequence, that under his supervision, the company was subverting local laws, and that he was running Uber with the professionalism of the leaders of Pi Kappa Phi. Before he was ousted as CEO, Uber was expected to go public, valued at more than $120 billion. Instead, the company was worth $40 billion less and has continued to fall ever since. While Dorsey is adored by a large swath of his employees, some outsiders, especially on Wall Street, believe he is no different, and several former board members and high-level executives at Twitter who have since become apostates of Dorsey, have pointed out to me how his morning ritual is full of holes not too dissimilar to Holmes's and Newman's. As for the 45 total minutes Dorsey allegedly spends in his 220-degree sauna at night, two World Sauna Championship competitors, yes, that's a thing, collapsed after spending 6 minutes in a sauna only a few degrees warmer than Dorsey's, which is already hotter than boiling water. After being dragged out, the competitors were treated for severe burns, and one of the men died. Then there is Dorsey's assertion that he is running both publicly traded companies while he works from home 2 days a week. Around the time Elliott Management reached out to discuss replacing Dorsey as chief of Twitter, the stock price had fallen 6.2% from 4.5 years before, when he'd retaken the helm and returned to the company for the third time. Yet, in that same period, thanks to Donald J. Trump, Twitter has become one of the most talked-about platforms on Earth. Additionally, the product has changed with languid speed. With the exception of doubling the size of a tweet from 140 characters to 280, and adding embedded images and videos, Twitter today is almost exactly the same product it was when it launched in March 2006, 14 years ago. Facebook, on the other hand, has morphed and changed with the tides of technology, is worth 25 times more than Twitter, and has more than 10 times as many active users. More telling is that Facebook's stock has risen 121% since Dorsey's return, even though Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has spent that same period of time embroiled in one controversy after another: fake news, Cambridge Analytica, and the 2016 election. As the cult of the founder has decayed, and Dorsey's daily rituals have been catapulted all over the internet by faithful and adoring fans, bankers on Wall Street have developed an immunity to Silicon Valley myth-making, of which Dorsey is the prime example. They have become fed up and believe Dorsey is either completely checked out of one or both companies, or has delegated so much responsibility that little beyond keeping the lights on and the servers running happens inside Twitter. As a CEO, some Wall Streeters and tech executives have come to believe and told me Dorsey relies too much on his carefully cultivated image. While he did co-found both startups, he did not remotely come up with either idea alone. This belief was only compounded in late November, when Dorsey was returning from his trip to Africa and tweeted from the Addis Ababa Bole International Airport in Ethiopia that he enjoyed his time on the continent so much he planned to live there for 3 to 6 months in 2020. At Twitter and Square, no one had any idea Dorsey was planning such an announcement, according to someone familiar with both companies. For some Twitter investors, it seemed to have been the last straw. But this would not be Twitter, and Dorsey would not be Dorsey, without a turn in the story, involving dangerous global events, the persistence of tech mysticism, and Dorsey's own fierce founder's ego. By early March, while Trump was taking to Twitter to proclaim that the deadly COVID-19 virus was just something that the fake news media and their partner, the Democrat Party, were trying to use to create panic and attack the Trump administration, Dorsey was realizing that he was indeed at risk of being ousted as CEO of Twitter, and that he was going to have to make a move. At a Morgan Stanley conference in San Francisco on March 5th, Dorsey blamed the stagnation at Twitter on the management of the company 5 years earlier. Yes, five. And defended his decision to kill Vine, which could have easily been the next TikTok, by saying that Twitter was doing too many things at the time. And while he didn't acknowledge the $40 billion elephant in the room, Elliot, Dorsey did announce on stage that his plan to move to Africa for 6 months was a mistake, and that in light of COVID-19 and everything else going on, I need to reevaluate. Presumably everything else was a euphemism for the barbarians storming the gates. Around this same time, there was another meeting in the Bay Area between Twitter's board and Elliot. Only this time, Dorsey showed up, with the goal of trying to charm the Elliot team in the same way he does the media, his celebrity friends, and most of his employees. While Dorsey's daily life might sound more like a candle you can buy at Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop store than the consequential liturgy of a man who oversees one of the most important social platforms on the planet, one aspect of Dorsey is not to be trifled with. While one high-profile Twitter investor once said, "Jack is like the main character in the film Being There, where the gardener accidentally becomes the president of the United States," Dorsey's ability to maneuver others in the boardroom is quite brilliant. His coup to return to Twitter in 2010 and push out his arch nemesis, Evan Williams, was operatic, to say the least. Dorsey was laser-focused on vengeance for 2 years and secretly met with Twitter employees, board members at the time, and allies in the media, moving secret chess pieces around San Francisco as he prepared his eventual attack, which ended with co-founder and then CEO Williams being forced to step down and Dorsey's return to the leadership team. When Dorsey later took over as CEO again, this time from Dick Costolo, 4.5 years ago, he did so with similar secrecy and sorcery. The second meeting between Twitter and Elliot, which was also in a neutral place, this time there were refreshments, began cordially enough. Dorsey was pleasant and thoughtful, and joked a little, as did Cohn. According to two people familiar with the discussions, Dorsey blamed the stagnation at Twitter again on his predecessor, Costolo. Yet, as one person in the meeting pointed out, Costolo left Twitter almost half a decade before, and the stock price was lower on that March day than it was when Costolo stepped down, although the markets had risen by double-digit percentages. It's also worth noting that Dorsey has been on the board of Twitter since the company was founded. Dorsey, according to one person familiar, had hoped he would be able to use his founder magic to charm the bankers, but it didn't seem to be working out that way. At times, the meeting grew tense, and the charisma Dorsey usually relies on in tense situations did not seem to sway the Elliott team. Whenever Dorsey and his compatriots are asked why he insists on running two companies, their go-to answer is that he is the co-founder, an argument that came up in this meeting as well, according to the person familiar. A year or two ago, that argument possibly would have sufficed, but now, in the face of a string of massively failed multi-billion-dollar companies, all led by founders, it's as if Wall Street has finally figured out that the magic trick doesn't always end with a rabbit being pulled out of a hat. In this particular meeting, it appeared that the numbers, most of which were underwhelming at best, overshadowed any conjuring founder tricks the Twitter team hoped Dorsey could pull off. Though there was a saving grace for Dorsey. On the sidelines of these talks, Egon Durban of Silver Lake, another investment firm which had been eyeing Twitter, swooped in and wanted to join the party. And after lengthy negotiations, Twitter and Elliot came to an agreement that in the media looked like a truce. The deal includes Silver Lake injecting $1 billion into Twitter, which will help the company fund a $2 billion share repurchase program. Cohn will get one board seat, and Silver Lake's co-CEO Egon Durban will get another. The third board seat will go to someone independent, who reflects Twitter's diversity, and unlike most of the current 8 board members, someone with technology expertise focusing on artificial intelligence. With 2 prospective investors, Dorsey did not march to the beat of a single drummer. He can remain CEO of both Twitter and Square, a narrow escape for now. For many in Silicon Valley and within the walls of Twitter, the announcement came as another win for Dorsey, where people believed that Elliott had lost its battle to oust the next Steve Jobs. Or was it? Twitter is no longer just a technology company. It is used by world leaders to wage war and local governments to warn of shutdowns. It's used by politicians to announce they are running for office, to declare they are suspending their campaigns, and to endorse other candidates. It's where news breaks and journalists find sources, where Trump pulls the levers of chaos and controls what will consume the nightly news or the morning headlines. During the spread of the coronavirus, it has been an invaluable place to share minute-by-minute mortality and epidemiology statistics from around the globe. Over time, Twitter has become less of a social network and more of a public utility. And yet, Dorsey insists it does not need a full-time CEO. While Twitter has continued to become an invaluable tool around the globe, it has, without much competition, become the most tumultuous and absurd company in the history of technology. With Dorsey as a constant board member, the company has gone through more than half a dozen product directors. Its CEO position has been a revolving door of chaos in 2 to 5 year increments. Its board has been no different, with people joining, forcing others out, and then being shoved off themselves. Other aspects of the company are more akin to a soap opera on Telemundo than any normal kind of corporate drama. For example, when Dorsey returned to the company after being ousted in 2008, his number one cheerleader and confidant was Peter Fenton, an early investor and board member who praised Dorsey as the greatest founder of his generation. But after Dorsey took over again as chief in 2015, some people who know Fenton say that the relationship soured, although one source close to Fenton disputes this and says the two are amicable. Either way, Fenton left his wife and kids and started dating Dorsey's on-and-off girlfriend of many years, Kate Greer. And in 2017, Fenton left Twitter entirely. Fenton and Greer now have a baby together. While Dorsey has managed to get Twitter's board under control, he has done so with people who do not question his actions, which has had the unintended consequence of setting himself up for external ridicule. And in the same way that the cult of the founder has started to wither, so has the role of a board overseeing a tech company, after the boards of WeWork, Theranos, and Uber, to name just a handful, looked the other way as their CEOs cooked the books or acted incongruously. If the board at Twitter was as aggressive as Elliott has been in just the past few weeks, it would have likely forced Dorsey to resign from Square years ago to run the social network exclusively, given the tepid growth, declining stock, and languid innovation when compared to other major players in the sector. As a CEO of another company once said to me, just because someone helped start the company doesn't mean they should be the person who runs it. Co-founder is not a job title. But that's no reason to doubt that in the dwindling twilight of the era of the tech CEO as near deity, money doesn't win. While Dorsey managed to stave off a coup by Elliott for now, Cohn is going to be sitting on the board of Twitter, leading an executive search that could recommend to replace Dorsey, though it will be left up to the board to decide if it wanted to follow through with those recommendations. And Dorsey is going to have to reach some pretty high metrics, including growing Twitter's monetizable daily active users, people who use the platform daily and can be served ads, by 20% in order to remain CEO of both companies. As a result of the pandemic and the vertiginous fall in the stock markets, 2 weeks later, Silver Lake's $1 billion investment had fallen by a third, as had Elliott's, which the bankers won't be too happy about. But in an uncanny twist, given the virus now decimating the global economy, Dorsey might have just received a stay of execution. Any stock declines will be attributed to coronavirus eviscerating the markets as a whole. According to someone familiar with the company's internal projections, the amount of time people spend on the site is expected to rise this quarter. While people around the globe are on lockdown in their homes, the one place millions are turning to for a constant flow of information is social media, especially Twitter. Most importantly for Dorsey is that with travel bans and social distancing, Cohn's CEO search will be limited, and the effing killer likely won't be able to attend the first board meeting in person, which means Dorsey won't be sweating as Cohn presses him with tough questions, unlike the board members who oversee the company now. But even the virus might not be enough to save Dorsey in the slightly longer term. According to one person familiar with Elliott and Silver Lake's thinking, there is another scenario. Inevitably, the two investment firms could team up and acquire Twitter, taking it private and turning it into a true global utility akin to a telecom or cable giant. If this were to happen, the board would be disbanded and Dorsey would be cast out and never let back into the building. Jesse Cohn will get his way, the Cohn Observer said. I can assure you, one way or another, Jesse will get his way. Jack has no chance. Club rules. When the commander-in-chief departs the White House, he's typically welcomed into a close-knit brotherhood of former presidents. In an exclusive excerpt from her new book, Team of Five, Kate Anderson Brower reveals why Donald Trump will be left out of the world's most elite fraternity. Adapted from Team of Five, The President's Club in the Age of Trump, by Kate Anderson Brower. Copyright 2020 by Kate Anderson Brower. To be published on May 19, 2020, by Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Excerpted by permission. It is a brilliantly sunny day in the spring of 2019 when I sit down across from President Donald Trump in the Oval Office, ready to discuss how he imagines a particular aspect of his post-presidential life, that of his relationship with his fellow former presidents. Because one overlooked casualty of Trump's norm-defying presidential tenure is the way he has upended the unspoken rules among living former presidents who have traditionally welcomed one another enthusiastically, regardless of party, into the world's most exclusive club. In the club, which has its own set of expectations and its own unique set of personalities, power is never completely relinquished. The four living former presidents will always be called Mr. President, and that is how they want it. During the Trump era, from January 2017 to November 2018, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama were all members of the so-called President's Club until the elder Bush's death. Despite their different political trajectories, all have lived their post-presidential years, fully understanding what is expected of them. Some are more engaged than others, but there is a precedent they all adhere to, with the exception of Carter, who has paid for his disobedience with occasional suspensions from the club. At times throughout history, other former presidents have shirked these rules, but doing so has come at a steep price. Their all-important legacies are forever tarnished. By the time I meet Trump in the Oval Office, I have already spent 2 years interviewing top aides, close friends, and family members of the former presidents, and traveled to Plains, Georgia, to sit down with the Carters. We are nearly a year away from the early uncertain days of the novel coronavirus pandemic, when Trump will tell a CNBC reporter, "We have it totally under control. It's going to be just fine." Former presidents used to help each other in times of crisis. Trump has made that impossible. He has not spoken with Obama or Clinton since his inauguration more than 3 years ago. Aside from a brief hello and goodbye to Obama during George H.W. Bush's funeral in December 2018. In fact, the only substantive conversation he and Obama have had was during the customary visit Trump made to the Oval Office 2 days after he won the 2016 election. He has been criticizing him ever since. "I didn't like the job that he and Biden did," Trump said at a Fox News town hall in March. "I didn't like the position they put us in." Seeking to justify his administration's bungled response to the novel coronavirus outbreak in America, he attacked Obama, tweeting that his handling of the 2009 H1N1 swine flu was a full-scale disaster, with thousands dying and nothing meaningful done to fix the testing problem. Contrast that with John F. Kennedy, who called on all three of his living predecessors to ask for their help during the Cuban Missile Crisis. A year and a half earlier, after the Bay of Pigs disaster, Kennedy had reached out to the man he'd just defeated, Richard Nixon, and to his Republican predecessor, Dwight D. Eisenhower. He knew he could not afford to be too proud to ask for help. No one knows how rough this job is until after he has been in it a few months, Kennedy confessed to Eisenhower. Ronald Reagan sent Nixon, Gerald Ford, and Carter to Anwar Sadat's 1981 Cairo funeral during a sensitive global moment that could have precipitated more violence. And then, there's the way the former presidents supported George W. Bush after 9/11, and how George H.W. Bush and Clinton traveled the world together, seeking help after the tsunami in Asia, and in their leadership roles raising money after Hurricane Katrina. They became near constant companions, doing interviews together and even traveling with George W. as part of the American delegation to Pope John Paul II's 2005 funeral in Rome. "Come on," Bush Sr. implored Clinton, "it will be better with you along." Nicknamed the A-Team in the press, they became like father and son. Time made them Partners of the Year in its 2005 Person of the Year issue. After seeing how powerful the Clinton-Bush team was, President Obama dispatched George W. Bush and Clinton to Haiti to raise awareness and funds after the devastating 2010 earthquake. This kind of teamwork and camaraderie now seems unthinkable and almost quaint. Former presidents typically don't initiate calls to the sitting president to offer their help because it would come across as meddling. But two people close to George W. Bush say that Bush is open to a call from Trump, even though there is no love lost between the two men. They haven't spoken at any length since two phone calls during the confirmation of controversial Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, who had worked in the Bush White House. One former top Trump official, who knows both men well, said that if Trump were to call on Bush for help during this pandemic, Bush would swallow hard and he would help, however he can, for the good of the nation. That's the kind of person he is. But Trump's doing that is nearly inconceivable. His ego and his dismissal of the former presidents are all part of his mindset, this person said, on the condition of anonymity. Early on, I was shocked by some of the things he said about the former presidents. It's not pretty. In my lifetime, I haven't seen a president so self-centered. Adding, it is ironic that Trump doesn't hesitate to call up strongman autocrats like Putin and Erdogan, who are not our friends. But he wouldn't call up Obama, Clinton, or even Bush during this crisis. Given all of this, it is hard to imagine that, whenever he does leave the White House, Trump will receive a warm welcome into the club. He has accused his immediate predecessor of wiretapping his office ahead of the 2016 election, and called his most recent Republican predecessor's foreign policy the worst in history. He perpetually notes that his relationships with other world leaders are better than those of former presidents. But have the years he spent in that awe-inspiring office given him empathy for what his predecessors went through? No, he replies flatly. Unlike most of the men who came before him, who aged prematurely and struggled with insomnia while in office, often pacing the halls of the White House in the dead of the night, overwhelmed by the gravity of the position, Trump said he has no trouble sleeping. When I ask him whether he would go to Obama's presidential library opening, the question sounds preposterous. Presidents have always attended one another's library openings as a sign of respect. But I don't know, he answers. He probably wouldn't invite me. Trump mulls it over for a moment and says, as though he had never thought of the far-reaching ramifications of his ostracism from the club, why should he? It is an astonishing reminder of just how much has changed. On the subject of the location of his own presidential library, he uses our interviews to distinguish himself from his predecessors and to take a swipe at them. That's a very interesting question. I have thought about it very little. I'm more thinking about all of the things that we're doing, which are a lot, he says, jutting his chin out proudly. I was left a lot. I was left a lot of problems that could have been solved a long time ago. I'm much more focused on that. He pauses. I have given it a little thought, and New York seems to be the most natural place, but Florida is another one. I know location, I guess, like nobody, says the former real estate developer. We'll pick somewhere very appropriate. He knows he will never be accepted into the club, and he wants to make it clear that he doesn't mind. When our interview comes to an end, and I'm on my way out, he shouts in a voice laden with sarcasm, "Say hi to President Bush for me." The Outsider. A year earlier, when I met with Jimmy and Rosalind Carter at their home in Plains, Georgia, in the spring of 2018, Carter was still harboring hopes of being dispatched by Trump to negotiate a nuclear deal with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. It always seemed far-fetched. In 2013, taking a dig at Obama, Trump wrote, "Former President Jimmy Carter is so happy that he is no longer considered the worst president in the history of the United States." In The Art of the Deal, Trump wrote that Carter had come to his office to ask for a $5 million donation to his presidential library. He was surprised that Carter had the nerve, the guts, to ask for something so extraordinary. Needless to say, Trump did not give it to him. He bragged about it, Carter said. That was one of his major selling points. I turned down Jimmy Carter. But Carter was one of the first people to call Trump to congratulate him on his election victory in 2016, a gesture Trump clearly appreciated. And friends say he is reluctant to attack Trump in part because the Carter Center needs to work with the State Department. In 2016, the Carters voted for Bernie Sanders and not Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary, and they do not feel much warmth toward the Obamas. They were clearly disappointed that the Obamas had not sought their advice on leading effective post-presidential lives, and Carter felt that Obama did not pay him the proper respect when he was president. When Carter called Obama to offer advice or to brief him on a foreign trip, he would often get a call back from Tom Donilon, the president's national security advisor, who had been an intern in the Carter White House. For a former president, that was the ultimate humiliation. Trump is sympathetic to the way Carter has been treated by the other former presidents, which is why Carter is the only former president he has sought advice from while in office. One quiet Saturday night in April 2019, as the former president was about to serve himself at the buffet table at a friend's house, a call came from a White House operator announcing that Trump wanted to talk to him about China and trade. Carter set his plate down at the buffet table and picked up the phone. Trump spoke for most of the call, but Carter was able to ask about the status of talks with North Korea, and he advised the president to be flexible with the North Korean leader. Carter got in a dig about Trump's national security advisor at the time, John Bolton, a staunch supporter of the war in Iraq, to which Trump replied, "I call the shots." According to a person in the room, the 10-minute call left Carter unmoved, and after they hung up, he went back to the table, piled with platters of food, and quietly filled his plate as though nothing had happened. Later, when it was clear that Trump would not be sending him to broker any deal with the North Koreans or anyone else, Carter didn't pull any punches. "I think he's a disaster," he said unequivocally. At a Carter Center event in June 2019, he went further, saying that a full investigation would show that Trump didn't actually win the election in 2016. He was put into office because the Russians interfered. Any chance of the two developing a relationship was over. When Trump was asked to respond to Carter's assessment of him a day later, Trump replied witheringly, "He's a nice man. He was a terrible president. He's been trashed with his own party." He's been trashed. The patriarch. Trump was always well aware of how the Bush dynasty viewed him. He was not part of the plan. Jeb Bush was supposed to win the Republican nomination, and Trump got in the way. But George H.W. Bush's dislike of Trump ran deeper than Trump assumes. Bush was particularly disturbed when Trump, who received 4 student deferments from military service between 1964 and 1968, and 1 medical deferment after college after a diagnosis of bone spurs in his heels, famously attacked John McCain at a Christian conservative gathering in the summer of 2015. "I like people who weren't captured," Trump said, referring to the Arizona senator's 5.5 years as a prisoner who was tortured at the infamous Hanoi Hilton when he was a Navy aviator during the Vietnam War. "He's not a war hero. He was a war hero because he was captured," Trump said, at the event in Iowa during the Republican primary. "I can't understand how somebody could say that and still be taken seriously," Bush said, particularly upset because of his own service during World War II. This was a painful time for Bush, who did not recognize his own Republican Party. "I'm getting old," he told friends, "at just the right time." The erstwhile friend. The election of 2016 was the most rancorous in modern history. But before things devolved, Trump had a mutually advantageous relationship with the Clintons. He got affirmation from the presence of the former president and sitting U.S. senator at his 2005 wedding to Melania, where Hillary Clinton sat in the front row during the ceremony. "I had a very good relationship with both Clintons, actually. They came to my wedding to the First Lady. They were there," he told me, which of course I knew because I'd seen the much-discussed, surreal photograph that showed the Clintons and the newly married Trumps beaming. The Clintons, in turn, got money. Trump made a $100,000 donation to the Clinton Foundation and other donations to Hillary's Senate campaigns before the two embarked on their jaw-dropping, no-holds-barred political feud. Bill Clinton may have been the reason Trump ran in the first place. He called Trump in late May 2015, a month after his wife announced her candidacy, and reportedly told him that he thought his message was resonating with frustrated conservatives who felt overlooked by the Republican establishment. He was intrigued when Trump confided in him that he was considering running for president. Clinton told Trump that he was tapping into a big part of the Republican electorate that was tired of career politicians. "It's a complicated story," Trump told me when I asked him directly whether Clinton encouraged him to run for president. Trump announced his candidacy weeks later. Clinton was a member of Trump National Golf Club in Briarcliff Manor, New York, 6 miles from the home the Clintons bought in Chappaqua after leaving the White House. Trump told New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd that he renovated the club in 1999 specifically to entice Clinton to join. It worked. "I'm proud to have him," Trump said when Clinton joined in May 2003. "He's a great gentleman, a good golfer, and a wonderful guy." Hillary even played golf there with her husband as part of his 65th birthday president. Remarkably, Bill Clinton still had a locker at the club during the heat of the campaign in the summer of 2016. New York-based radio host Boomer Esiason tweeted a photo of Clinton's locker that summer and wrote, "Next to my locker at Trump National, only in New York." When I asked Trump if he could see himself becoming friendly with a former president after leaving office or rekindling a friendship with Bill Clinton as one-time rivals and former presidents John Adams and Thomas Jefferson had done, he said, "It's possible." Anything's possible. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights. Streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.